welcome to another Comic Boom Comic Source collaboration. It's your DC Spotlight for the week of April 23rd, 2024. Winding down the month of April here with an okay week. I don't know, maybe I've been spoiled. We've had some really, really great weeks from DC recently. And that's not to say that anything this week I thought was really bad, but it's another one of those weeks where, you know, the low wasn't low, but the high wasn't necessarily that high either. Just kind of a meh week. And I think kind of adding to that was, you know, there's a couple of titles that I normally really enjoy that are out this week that I thought they were kind of below average for that particular title. So I don't know. What did you think, Rocky? Up week, down week?
It's a little bit of a slightly on the downside. You know, there's maybe two that I really enjoyed or I thought were okay. But yeah, it was a little bit of a down week. So for me as well. And I probably have more rants than raves this week. But, you know, you gotta spread them out. So it is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully it won't be too bad. But we're going to kick it off with Power Girl number 8. Now, this is interesting. There's no color artist credited in this, which is really strange in the credits. But when I look on other sites, it says it's Romulo Fajardo Jr. So I'm not sure, but Leah Williams on writing, pencils by Eduardo Panseca, inks by Julio Ferreira, letters by Becca Carey. And the reason I bring that up is I kind of thought visually this was kind of a down week for this book. I mean, I hear Eduardo Panseca, and I'm really excited, especially with Julio Ferreira inking. But this art didn't feel very dynamic to me. And part of it is, I think the colors are not vibrant at all. And it's not like it's a pastel kind of thing like they do sometimes or whatnot. It's just, I don't know, the colors feel a little washed out. And I think it contributes to the book not feeling very dynamic. It kind of feels, I don't know. I don't want to say old fashioned, but it just feels it's lacking impact. The art is lacking impact. And then when it comes to the story, it's a sort of a crossover with the House of Brainiac, which is okay. I like that. That makes sense based on what we've seen in recent Action Comics and Superman issues. And, you know, Power Girl is considered part of that family. We even get an explanation about why she was left behind. The problem I have with it is for like the first, I don't know, third of the book, let's say, it's Power Girl and she's rollerblading in the park with Omen, maybe for the first 25% of the book. And, you know, she's talking about her recent adventures in the, you know, fantasy land that she went to, Frambia, and then making a date with this guy. And it's so cringy. Normally I'm a huge fan of Leah Williams and her writing and her dialogue, but it just felt so cringy to me and so boring. Like I don't care about her trying to make a date. Like, let's get going. Like, what are we doing here? I didn't care for the feel of it at all. It was just a slog to get there. It's only like six or seven pages, but I was falling asleep trying to get through those first few pages. And again, you know, part of it might be due to the coloring on the artwork where it just, yeah, this was maybe my least favorite, issue of the Power Girl series so far. Once it kind of gets going with the Brainiac drone showing up and the Zarnian showing up, you know, the action gets better and the pacing gets better, and it feels a little bit more like a traditional, you know, Power Girl issue, but the art still holds it back in my mind. So yeah, this was definitely one of those books I can point to this week where, man, normally I'm really enjoying Power Girl. Nah, not this issue. It really kind of, I really feel let down by this issue. So even the covers, you know, like theoretically I should really like these covers, but even the covers feel like they let me down. There is one that's by Mark.
You didn't like this cover? I'm really surprised. That was my first comment. I really love this cover with Crush. Yeah. I quite like it.
again, like I, in theory, I should love this, right? Like it's Yannick Paquette and it feels like it's got a little bit of homage to Adam Hughes. There's a Mark Brooks cover. He's one of my favorite artists. His is a direct homage to Adam Hughes. It even says on the cover that it's an homage to Adam Hughes. But even, yeah, that one there. But even that, it just doesn't feel like it's up to the usual standards that I...
Maybe it's AI.
No, Mark would never do that. But yeah. part of it is there's too much red. I don't like, you know, there's so much red. And then her cheeks. Why are her cheeks so red? I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm just crotchety, grouchy old man this week. But yeah, in theory, I should love these covers. And even the covers are just kind of meh. So I don't know. What'd you think of it?
My opinions are, well, it's higher than yours on the covers. Anyway, or at least on the cover. I like cover A because one of the things I'm always bitching about is how the covers don't relate to the content. This does. And I actually think it's funny too. I love how Paquette and Eric Prianto, how they sort of, they drew the fake breasts on Crush because Crush has basically small breasts. And I liked how they sort of, she's wearing a shirt with breasts on it with the window that Power Girl usually has. And Crush shows up and the story is actually called House of Brainiac. Paige has a crush. And of course, it's not only alluding to the fact that she's got a crush on this guy named Axel, who's a thief, but also, of course, Crush shows up, who's a Zarnian. And just as the Zarnians are attacking Metropolis, Crush happens to be in Metropolis, and Crush has a gang. She hangs out with a gang called the Holiday Girls, which, that's news to me. I didn't know Crush... I didn't know Crush lived in Metropolis, but maybe she does. I'm trying to remember the Crush and Lobo series. I thought Crush had a girlfriend, and I would have thought maybe she'd be hanging out with her girlfriend, but I guess not. Now, having said all that, I actually agree with you that the first third of the issue is just killing time with her rollerblading, which was a little bit frustrating for me. I admit that. I don't mind the art. I think it's decent enough. But I will say that one of the things that really bugged me here, and maybe I'm being a little bit cranky on this title like you are too, just for this particular issue, is I don't like how Omen is reading Power Girl's mind. And Power Girl even has a psychic jerk jar. Every time Omen violates and reads her mind, Omen has to put some money in the jar, and they sort of make a joke out of it. I don't think it's a joke. And I'm wondering if Leigh Williams is planting some seeds of a breakup. If I had a roommate, I mean, just thinking out loud here. I mean, if I'm thinking out loud, because you can't read my mind. But see what I did there? Anyways, if a roommate was reading my mind all the time, that would wear on me. And Omen's been doing that with Paige, with Power Girl, and it hasn't really pissed her off yet. Although they sort of play it off as kind of a joke. Omen already did that by reading the minds of teenagers in a previous issue. I thought in a very disturbing way, and it was sort of like breezed over. I don't think this should be breezed over. I think it's a violation, and I think it's maybe I'm nitpicking here, but I don't like it. I actually wonder if Omen has any friends. I don't think Omen has a lot of friends. Now, I actually thought Power Girl did have a lot of friends until Leigh Williams scripted her as not having very many friends, and then now her friends have to be the Superman family. I like the iteration of Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti, where Karen Starr had a little bit more agency and more social connections as she's being scripted here. But it's all well and good. I like the fact that when the Zarnians attack, Power Girl dives right in. I like the fact that she's the reason why she's not incapacitated and essentially kidnapped and put on Brainiac's ship is because the Brainiac is searching for people with powers, but because she's from Earth 2, or she's basically a multiversal outlier, Power Girl, she has a different energy reading than other Kryptonians on the Earth, and so she's perfectly suited, of course, to be a protector of Metropolis because she can't be found and zapped away like even Streaky the cat was. At the end of this issue, not surprisingly, she ends up meeting with Crush. Crush incapacitates her, and that's really how the issue ends. And Crush and her own gang are going to sort of, I guess, will probably play a role. Just like Lobo's teaming up with Superman, it's Crush. Crush sort of teaming up with Power Girl in the pages of Power Girl. It's a good idea. I just hope that next issue we have a little bit more action and not so much page filler as we did this issue that I don't think really moved the narrative forward. But overall, I didn't mind it, but I agree with you that the first third could have been pages better spent on dealing with more of the central plot as opposed to just unnecessary dialogue. But overall, meh.
Yeah, meh. And, you know, again, the opportunity to tie in with this big event, House of Brainiac, and now it sort of seems like, okay, she did her obligatory tie-in part. Now she's going to go and tell the story that she wants to tell, I guess. We've got Zarnians that hit out and didn't want to go back and work for Brainiac. I don't know. It feels it feels a little weird. I don't know. So anyway, we'll see how the next issue plays out. Maybe we can – you know, predict what direction it'll head based on that. We'll see. Up next, we have Detective Comics number 1084, written by Rom V, art by Javier Fernandez, colors by Dave McKang, letters by Ariana Mayer. Maybe this is a trend here. I didn't feel like this art was up to par with some of the more recent art we've had on the issues. And again, I'm going to point to the color work. This whole issue just feels brown to me, so much brown, and I just didn't care for it. I didn't care for the art. I don't particularly care. There's like a flashback sequence where none of the panels have borders on them. I feel that contributes to the washed out look as well. As far as Batman being back in Gotham, that part is sort of interesting. It's the most interesting part of the book to me, because he's back. He has this conversation with Jim Gordon. They're standing on this rooftop and they're talking about how crime is down and people seem to be happier. It's a golden city, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of the things they're saying, I'm like, well, that's a good thing, right? Like, that's a good thing that this is Gotham. And like, don't even recognize it as Gotham. Oh, but on the other hand, there are people that are kind of the marginalized people in Gotham that are still suffering, right? They're being kind of swept under the rug or what have you. It's not so dissimilar from when you have giant events here in the United States, whether that be San Diego Comic-Con near the convention center every July when Comic-Con happens, or whatever particular town hosts the Super Bowl here every year. And they go in and they relocate the homeless. So it gives a sense of, you know, more prosperity and, the things are better than they actually are. It's not reality, but it's all about perception, right? So I guess that's what's happening here. Because otherwise, when you look at it and you go, well, if it's better when you supposedly were dead, Batman, is this like a Gotham War situation again? Where it's like, well, if things are exponentially better in Gotham City when you're not there, Batman, maybe you need to take a look in the mirror. You know, maybe you're part of the problem, not part of the solution, with drawing all these supervillains and violence and, crazy events that cause damage to property and what have you. But, you know, it is sort of hinted at that that's not actually true. It's more of a perception thing from the outside looking in. It may appear that things in Gotham are better with the Orgums kind of calling the shots, but in reality, they're not. Either way, I do find that to be interesting, and it would have been nice to kind of focus on that a little bit more. I know it's been mentioned previously, but instead, it's like the things that we've been focusing on have been these kind of esoteric ideas from Rom V, which makes sense if you know the guy, if you know his writing and what have you. And it's not necessarily something that shouldn't be focused on. But again, the problem I've had with this Batman run is it's gone on for so long. I don't have the energy anymore. I'm so ready to get to the end of this story. It's been like 2 years. 2 years we've been going on this. And this is one of those issues where it feels like we're no closer to the end than we have. There have been times where it feels like, oh, we finally got some momentum going. But in this issue, like, what happens? He flashes back to after he came out of the desert and had some conversations with Talia. And he has a conversation with Jim Gordon. And that's it. And that's it. Like, oh my God. I can't even anymore with this. It's just taking too long. Now, I will say the backup story with one of your favorite characters, Lady Shiva, and another one of your favorite characters, for that matter, the Cassandra Cain Batgirl. It's written by Alex Paknadel, Robbie Rodriguez on art. I'm not the big fan of Robbie Rodriguez, but he does an okay job here. Patricio Del Pesce on color, Steve Wands on letters. I thought that was really action-packed and interesting, and I kind of love the how Alex Paknadel leans into this idea of Cassandra Cain, even though she's not, you know, the biggest in terms of stature. You know, she's physically just not that big. She's limited in how much pain she can inflict, how much damage she can inflict on somebody just based on her slight size. But right in the beginning, you know, she's in her mind going over the different parts of human anatomy, going, I'm going to do this to this bone. I'm going to do this to this tendon. I'm going to do this to this ligament. You know, as she's fighting these guys, she has this intimate knowledge of human anatomy that allows her to inflict maximum damage for the amount of force she's able to generate in that, you know, slider frame, which I just, that's what the things that I love about Cassandra Cain, you know, that and her kind of silent approach. I mean, it's gone away from it now. When she first showed up in the pages of Batman, like, she never talked. She rarely talked, even out of costume. And that's still a characteristic of her, but not, you know, they don't lean into it as much as they did in the beginning. But yeah, this silent, sort of deadly ninja-like character. And this was a reminder of that. So I did really enjoy the backup. I got to say, a lot more than the main story. Again, I'm just so ready to get to the end. And I'm just starting to get this feeling that we're going to get to the conclusion of this long, epic run on Detective from Rom V. And I'm not going to feel satisfied with the ending. The ending's going to be so decompressed that it's not going to land with any sort of impact. That's the fear I'm starting to have. So I really hope that I'm wrong. I really, really hope that I'm wrong. you know, as much as I kind of complain, I think overall, my reviews have tended to be more negative than positive on Detective Comics, but I have nobody to really blame but myself when it comes to this sort of thing, because this is a book that I buy every month, every, you know, week when it comes out biweekly or whatever, because I have a huge run, right? Detective Comics, Action Comics, Amazing Spider-Man. These are books I'm always going to buy. I won't say necessarily out of habit, but it's the collector side of me, right? Like, I've got massive runs of these series. Obviously, I don't have a complete run of Amazing Spider-Man. I'm never going to own number one. It's, you know, $1 million or whatever. Same thing with Detective 27. You know, even a lot of those early issues, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm never going to own those. But, you know, my collection goes back into the 300s, you know, 700 issues without missing an issue. And so even though I'm not necessarily enjoying this, and the only vote I really have would be with my wallet, right, not to buy it. I can't not buy it. So I'm, you know, I understand I'm being a hypocrite when it comes to that. Same thing with Action. You know, even during the Bendis run, where I really wasn't enjoying it, I was still buying it because, again, you know, my collection there goes back to close to issue 300. Right now I'm working on filling in issues 300 and 400. So, but anyway, I digress. What did you think of this issue of Detective? Am I crazy?
Well, you're not crazy. I love this issue. And you know, it's funny because I say that because for all those reasons that you gave that you felt were missing in the issue, I thought were in the issue. And in particular, I thought like this issue is even called Crescendo Part One. And this is really building to a crescendo. And to me, I mean, it had Batman. It continues from last issue where Batman lands on the car. You know, he's overcome the Asmir, and he takes out Killer Croc, and he confronts Gordon, and he talks to the Question. He gives Rene Montoya videotape from the Wayne Manor that shows how Lieutenant Fielding, Detective Fielding, was in fact killed, and so more evidence against the Orgums that orchestrated the murder of the Officer Fielding. And we learn that Talia al Ghul actually hired Lady Shiva to obtain and steal the coffin that contained the body of Asmir Orgum, who betrayed his mother to save Batman. And then Bruce Wayne sleeps with Talia. I mean, Catwoman is the one who saved his ass. And then, of course, Talia does, taking him out to the desert. Batman comes back from the desert. He sleeps with Talia and finds out from Talia that the Asmir, they got Asmir's body. And Talia wants to resurrect Asmir Orgum because it was Roz. Roz actually was involved in essentially having to sacrifice as Arzen's father, the original King Orgum. And so she's going to resurrect. It looks like she's going to resurrect Arzen Orgum. And so while she's doing that, Batman says, I have to go back. And I really want to build on something you said, because I think you nailed it. But then you come to a different conclusion than I do. You talk about how in the end you talked about it as if there was no consequence, that Gotham does seem to be a better place. And I thought they did talk about it. You said that you wish they would have talked about it more. I thought they talked about it just enough that it enticed me, where it shows Batman walking on the in the desert away from Talia, talking about, I will become consequence. The Orgums have got to know that you can't change without consequences, the ultimate lie. That's ultimately what he tells Gordon. And even Gordon reinforces that to him. And Gordon is trying to boost up Batman by basically telling him that, you're right. I mean, you can't save people by controlling them like the Orgums do. You save them by standing opposed to what is hurting them. And that's what Batman needs to hear. And he thanks Jim Gordon for that. And then he even subsequently thanks Selina, but he doesn't thank her directly. He just says, I'm in a good place now, thanks to you, Selina. But he doesn't directly thank Selina. And Selina ends up almost, I don't know what Selina was expecting, but Selina, Catwoman, goes off and ends up talking to the Joker in this issue. It's like she's almost pissed off at Bruce, because she says never again. She tried to save him. And so much has happened in this issue. And there's even like a cinematic moment, like reminiscent of the Bat movie, where Batman wants to show a sign to the Orgum Queen and he causes an explosion with a bat symbol on the side of a building. He's announcing he's not going to use stealth. Catwoman even says that's not a very stealthy move. He doesn't care. Batman's not being subtle anymore. He wants the Orgum Queen to know that he's coming because he knows how to fight off the Asmir. And I don't know. I just felt this was Batman sort of kicking some ass. And because one of the central complaints that I've had up until this series, it's not a complaint, but it's just a reality. You always want to tear a hero down before you build him up again. Well, this is Batman building up again. And I really enjoyed this issue. I thought it succeeded on that level. And it's interesting that you felt that it did not, or not as much as I did. But because this is probably going to be my pick of the week or close to it. We'll see if that changes by the time we're done reviewing all the comics, but I really enjoyed it. And of course, Lady Shiva, Cassandra Cain, the backup issue, absolutely love that. I loved how Lady Shiva saw that Cassandra was trying to be Batman rather than being herself. And by doing that, she was betraying, because Batman always wants Cassandra Cain to be the best that she can be. He doesn't want her to be him. And Lady Shiva knows that. And Lady Shiva loves her daughter, but has obviously a very Lady Shiva way of showing it. And I thought Bram V just, or actually Pachnidale, the writer, did a really good job of that. And these two stories fit together. The backup fit with the main story. And I just feel we're finally hitting our stride here near the end. And you, you would finally be happy, but apparently it's not fast enough for you, Jace.
No. I mean, and here's the thing, right? Like, yes, I, at no point did I say, nothing happens in this issue or whatever, but because there are, it is a lot of moving pieces and but it feels all like setup, and I'm just tired of the setup. Let's get to it already. And you're right. I mean, they do, Gordon and Batman do talk about that. They have a conversation about, hey, is Gotham better off or whatever? And then they come to the conclusion it's all perception or what have you. When I say, I wish I'd talked about it more, I mean, I wish that had been, this series has been going on for 2 years. And now's the time where Ron V goes, okay, let's talk about this now. This should have been, in my mind, one of the things that should have constantly come up throughout the series. That would have been interesting to me to hear other people's perspectives. Like, Batman's dead, Batman's gone, Batman's not in Arkham. And do we have any conversations with people saying, God, I'm glad Batman's gone. Batman's dead, and look at how much better we off. No, like, it's not mentioned at all until this issue. And it's like, Ron V goes, well, let me check that box and talk about how, hey, Gotham might be better off without Batman. But then in the same conversation that Batman and Gordon have, it's pushed it, like, it's brought up and then it's resolved. No, but it's all perception. Like, that's what I'm saying about, I wish that it had been brought up more, because look at what happened with you and I and the debate that we had during Gotham War. Like, for the first, two thirds of Gotham War, it was like all we could talk about. It came up. It was like a big debate between you and I throughout. And unfortunately it like pivoted and that got thrown away. And we lamented that about how that was the most interesting aspect of Gotham War. And, as we sit here and bring it up, I'm thinking, what are the consequences really of Gotham War? Like, what a waste of an event, right? Like, it's over and done with and nobody cares and it doesn't even really have any consequence. You could argue, well, maybe Vandal Savage, there's some stuff to come or whatever, but kind of like Night Terrors. What a waste of time, what Night Terror stuff are we still talking about? Future State's another one. I could go on and on. Now, in the case of Future State, like, thank God they're not referencing it anymore. Thank God that Future State Gotham series finally came to an end, because, man, that was maybe the biggest train wreck DC's had in the last – God, I can't believe it, Gotham – our Future State was 2021. It's already was over 3 years ago.
Yeah. Thank God. Time flies, my friend.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So, anyway, let's move on. It's DC, so, of course, we have more Batman. Batman Brave and the Bold, number 12. Starting off with the final part of Batman Mother's Day. It's part 3 by Carl Kerschel, handling the writing and art. M. Stasiak on colors, Steve Wan's on letters. Then we have Left Unsaid, which is a Swamp Thing story. Rob Levin is the writer, Mike Norton on art, John Kalis on colors, Troy Petrie on letters. Artemis, The Poison Within, part 3. Oh, boy. Delilah S. Dawson, Serge Acuna, Matt Herms, Dave Sharp. I'm going to handle that one. Writer, artist, colors, and letters, respectively. And then A Parting Gift by Zipporus Smith as the writer. Carl Mostert on art, Mike Spicer on colors, Dave Sharp on letters. And then a black and white Batman story written by Herrick Hanna. Charlie Adler handles the art, Tom Napolitano on letters. So we'll kick it off by talking about this Mother's Day part 3 story. It's no surprise, because Carl Kerschel created Maps Mizuguchi and wrote Gotham Academy, where she was a big part of the story, what have you. So it's not a big surprise to see him really giving a lot of agency to Maps, and she's a bit of a fan favorite as well. But the last thing we need is another Robin. But yet she is fully officially a Robin in this issue. Batman calls her Robin. She gets a cause. Now, again, you could say, well, it's not really in continuity. I mean, Alfred's still alive in the story, for goodness sake. So maybe it's not really in continuity or whatever. But she gets a full costume and Batman refers to her as Robin. So will we see more of her as Robin? Is she officially a Robin? I guess – it could go either way. But setting that aside, this is a fun story. It is kind of a lighthearted story. You don't need to reread anything else. Clearly, it's not in continuity, at least with current Bat continuity of what's going on. There's no fail-safe. Bruce isn't struggling. In fact, like I said, Alfred's still alive, and it also appears that he never lost his fortune. So this is good for you know, what it is, which is just a good standalone Batman story, you know, that can be read probably by younger readers, you know, readers who are fans of Gotham Academy, getting a chance to see maps and what have you. The art's really strong from Carl Kerschel, as it always is. And yeah, I think it works on that level. So for the most part, I enjoyed this. But I don't know, maybe it's just the continuity nerd in me, but like, just at the beginning, just say this is out of continuity, or say it happens before issue such and such in Batman. Yeah, well, I guess it would have to be before Joker War. So, you know, we know, hey, this fits over here or whatever, or what have you. So, but anyway, overall, I thought it was a lot of fun. But yeah, don't think we need another Robin. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah. I love Carl Kerschel's run. I've got both series of Gotham Academy. I've enjoyed it. I think this is his best. I consider this a Gotham Academy story. I think this is one of his best ones. I really enjoyed this. I love the fact that Maps is Robin. And I love the fact that, I know the continuity is wonky, like, as you've already said. I don't care. And I know I'm kind of being a hypocrite. Sometimes wonky continuity bothers me, sometimes it doesn't. But hey, we can all pick and choose. I love Maps. And I love the fact that she's also in Birds of Prey. And I love the fact a future Maps is in Birds of Prey, and that she can look back and brag that she was once Robin, legitimately. And I got no problem manipulating my headcanon against all time displaced odds and making this fit. I like this. This is a vampire story. Bruce Wayne is bitten by a vampire. Batman and the mother is the mother of all the vampires. And Maps legitimately rescues Bruce Wayne, actually gives him injects him with the antidote to prevent him from fully changing into a vampire or whatever version of vampire this is. She takes him, rescues him, puts him into an ambulance that's driven by Alfred. And meanwhile, that leads Batman to determine and finally after this, because this feels like this is a fourth or fifth chapter of this, where this isn't just the first story either. We've had a number of stories with Bruce Wayne slowly getting to know Maps. Those of us who've been reading Brave and the Bold over time, and I think it even may have started even in Urban Legends, this is something that's been building for a while, but it hasn't had its own series. So I feel that Maps has organically become Robin. It feels a little bit organic to me. This doesn't feel forced. That's what I like about it. It feels like she's actually legitimately earned this. And so that's what I really like about it. And she's likable. God damn, I like her more than I initially liked Jason Todd and Tim, I got to tell you that. So I thought this was well done. I even like the hint of a love interest with Isla, which and how Bruce Wayne intentionally becomes a jerk at the end of this story. Instead of going back to Isla, who he does have feelings for, he reinforces his playboy image by not going back to her and going on a yacht. And the news is reporting that he's with a Hollywood Scarlet. And I mean, just Carl Kerschel covered all the angles here. He fully resolved the entire plot line. Everything resolved with the hint that the vampire's heart is elsewhere in the world and Bruce Wayne's going to find it one day. So a hint at a future story. So I thought all the ducks were in a row. I thought this was very well done. I just wish I would have loved for this to have been selfishly its own series, but unfortunately DC and maybe with the sales woes and everything else, nonetheless, I would have loved to have seen this as its own individual Gotham Academy six-issue miniseries than in the pages of Brave and the Bold, because I haven't been buying the physical copies of this, to be honest with you. Now I kind of regret it, because you said it. Speculator alert, Brave and the Bold, Batman Brave and the Bold number 12. Maps officially becomes Robin, arguably. This is the official. They hinted at it, but they've teased it and they've suggested it through dialogue in previous issues. But this is really official because she's actually given a costume while in the Batcave in this particular issue. So that, in my view, makes it official. I enjoyed this story.
Yeah, it's a good point. She has earned the role. And yes, we have seen Maps. This does Carl Kerschel. It's funny. DC has just shoehorned these Gotham Academy stories in wherever, right? In various anthologies, backups for the various Bat titles, what have you. And it has felt like a progression that she's gradually earned this, which is great, right? That's how it should be. That's sort of how it was with Dick Grayson. It's definitely how it was with Jason Todd and Tim Drake. You maybe say the one Robin where it wasn't the case, and in that way probably never should have been Robin, would be Damian Wayne. That it was done in a completely different way, right? Almost backwards. You know, you think about Batman taking on a Robin, and he's taking somebody who doesn't have all the skills, but he takes them under his wing and he's training them, he's mentoring them, what have you. The argument could be made that Damian Wayne, right from the start when he shows up to his, you know, father's mansion or whatever, is as accomplished a fighter and as accomplished a martial artist and whatever as Batman himself is. That's not the part that he needs to learn. It's all the other stuff. Needs to learn not to be a brat, not to be a punk. So in my mind, like, and Damian Wayne is always and probably always will be my least favorite Robin. He probably never should have been Robin in that way. Like, they should have, and I don't mean he shouldn't have teamed up with Batman, but I kind of wish they'd given him a different code name, because this has a different feel, right? Maps as Robin has a different feel. This feels like somebody who's just starting out, who Batman is going to mentor and teach and what have you. Where it, you know, it was never that way with Damian at all. So anyway, let's move on. I think I said that the second story was a Swamp Thing story. Sorry, I got confused. It's not a Swamp Thing story. It's a Gentleman Ghost and a False Face story. False Face being this master of disguise, Batman villain, what have you. Here, the way they portray him is a little more of I don't want to say an anti-hero, but a little more neutral, where he's not necessarily a bad guy, not necessarily a good guy. He basically will take money to impersonate people, for whatever reason. Now, whether that's something nefarious or whether it's with good intentions or what have you, he doesn't care. He just wants to cash the check. So it's an interesting story. It is one of those issues or one of those stories where it feels like, well, I can't tell you the last time False Face showed up. Or I even heard the name False Face. So time to renew that copyright, time to renew that trademark for DC. If you don't use a copyright, if you don't use a trademark for an extended period of time, it lapses into the public domain. So that's sort of what this feels like. It's like DC reached out to, you know, a few different creators and said, hey, you know, you got a pitch for a False Face story, because this copyright's come and due and we need a story. And, you know, credit where credit's due. It's pretty interesting from Rob Levin here. Basically, what happens is this woman hires False Face to come and impersonate her son, because her son abandoned his wife and daughter, this woman's granddaughter, years and years ago. He was a cop in Gotham City, and he was corrupt, and he was an alcoholic, and he was, you know, abusive mentally, physically, emotionally. And so she hires False Face, this grandmother hires False Face, to go and apologize to the daughter, saying, you know, it wasn't anything wrong with you, it was totally me, it was my own issues, you know, whatever. Well, come to find out, that family, the cop and the grandmother and the daughter, or the granddaughter, they're descendants of Gentleman Ghost, of Craddock. And when he finds out, when Gentleman Ghost finds out, he's pissed off at False Face, because he doesn't feel like you can resolve things like this by telling lies. You know, you have to. It's his whole sense of honor, right? So, you know, you can't do that. And he goes to False Face and he says, "You need to fix this." And False Face is like, "What are you talking about? Like, how can I fix this?" And Gentleman Ghost is like, you find a way to fix it that's not a lie, or, you know, I'm going to come back and, you know, I won't be so nice the second time around. And he wasn't particularly nice this time either. He kind of beats the crap out of False Face. But you sort of feel like this is a story that's going to be forgettable. Like, it didn't really seem to have a point. But other than maybe it renews the copyright, but it was enjoyable. I mean, I'm a big fan of Gentleman Ghost. I like his, I love Gentleman Ghost, the aesthetic, the way he looks. And yeah, I couldn't tell you the last time I read a False Face story. So yeah, I enjoyed this. I thought the art was really strong as well. So yeah, overall, this was a good one. What'd you think?
I thought this story was really cool. I liked it. It made Gentleman Ghost. He's a badass. I basically saying, look, this is my family. I mean, maybe a couple generations removed, because the Gentleman's Ghost is probably a couple hundred years old. I can't remember how. I'm not an expert on Gentleman Ghost. I know he's probably over a century old. But I like the fact that he killed the father of his descendants. I mean, he was a piece of garbage. He was an abuser. And the Gentleman Ghost, you don't know. He tell the truth. And he tells the grandmother at the end. He tells her, you know, he basically, you know, your son got what he deserved. I mean, or at least the faceless mask or man there or whatever said that to her. And it's the truth. And it's dropping truth bombs here. And I like it. And it doesn't sugarcoat it either. And I kind of like that because, you know, I'm kind of on, it kind of irritates me lately. There's an increasing number of comics by the big two that I think are sugarcoating a lot of things. There's this movement away from evil that I don't like. And there's I like this. This was visceral. It was the type of the harsh truth that actually helps people. And it came from Gentleman Ghost, a ghost, a super villain. And I thought it really worked well. And actually, I think this story stands out. It's memorable. I'm going to remember this story. And so, yeah, it's good stuff. Good work.
All right. Next up, we have the Artemis story that's been going on for, I guess this is the third issue now. It's been problematic. Yeah, it's been problematic at best. And I've tried to stay positive with it. I'm trying not to rake it over the coals. And I will say that in terms of kind of context and tying in with what's going on with Amazonian stories, Wonder Woman stories currently, at least it's moving toward being a story that does matter and does tie in. Up to this point, it's sort of been this story about Artemis being wildly out of character. Oh, woe is me. I can't believe my fellow Amazon sisters believed I could have killed Hippolyta out of cold blood. It's been really mopey and weepy and whiny. So at least we get some action here, and at least we are having some context where it ties into what's going on with the Amazon Extradition Act and that sort of thing. The problem I have with it is it's so like over the top to the point of just pissing me off, like really pissing me off. Like I want to reach in and like beat the shit out of some of these characters.
It's like I'm listening to myself talk.
Yeah, they're so stupid. They're so illogical and stupid and nonsensical. I literally want to reach through the comic and throttle Sergeant Steel to death. Like, I'm reading this story and I'm thinking right along with Artemis, okay? Like, yes, Amazon Extradition Act, we can argue whether or not it's, you know, constitutional or legal or should have come to pass or whatever. But all along I'm thinking, but she's not in the United States. And sure enough, she says, but I'm not in the United States. Yeah. Fuck you, Sergeant Steele. I'm not. And what does he do? He goes, oh, you're not on American soil. And he throws some dirt on her. Here's American soil. Now, like, no, you piece of shit. That's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. Like, it's okay to try to tell some stories that are meta and are political. And you get into, you know, some kind of sensitive areas of, you know, xenophobia and that sort of thing. And it's okay. But when you take it this far, it stops being entertaining and just ends up being, I don't even know what the word is. Like, it just ends up being fodder to piss me off, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I'm not the only one pissed off, but this is not enjoyable. It's not enjoyable to see characters and don't get me wrong. I know Sergeant Steel has never been like this out and out hero. I mean, he was sort of more on the hero side when he, you know, first showed up until they did the first Amazon attack story. And then they kind of made him this douchebag type character, which I thought was kind of reductive to the character and kind of wasted any potential that he had to really be seen as like a war hero or that sort of thing. But again, like making him this Amanda Waller type character, right, where you just love to hate him. And I don't know. It just seems lazy to me. because at least the way Tom King has written them, you can make the argument that he's being unduly influenced by the sovereign, you know, maybe he's being mind controlled or whatever. But when it comes to where you're taking it this far, the way the writer here, Dawson, has taken it, like it transcends that. It just becomes mean spirited. And it's not entertaining to read. It's not. Like, I finished reading this story and it put me in a bad mood. Like, I was just pissed. I was just mad. I didn't want to read comics anymore because I don't think you ever want to write a comic book that makes you not want to read comics, but that's what this did. Wow. Because the characters are just wildly unlike these soldiers. And it's not just Sarge Steele. It's all the soldiers, because the other soldiers making comics as well. They're just so wildly unlikable. It's like, why would I want to read this? Why would I want to read this? Like, even if I was a huge Artemis fan, at least, again, she's feeling like she's a little more in character here. She's not so whiny and weepy, but that's probably because, you know, what she has to do here is fight, you know, and that's where Artemis is at her best as a character. But the rest of it, it could have been done in a different way where you still add the context of the Extradition Act and what have you that made sense. Because at the end of the day, that's the other thing that bothers me, right? Like, this doesn't make sense. You can't, as American military, first of all, you can't just go into another country with, you know, military assets and military weapons and what have you and pursue somebody. That's an act of war. You can't do that. And even setting aside if they got permission, it's still what they're doing is so despicable and disgusting that I can't help but be just so annoyed by it to the nth level. I just hate this. I hate everything about this story. it goes back. And even though I was trying to put a positive spin on the first two parts of it, like, this makes those worse now, because this is what what those two issues are building up to. Like, I can't remember the last time I read a comic I hated as much as this. Like, I despise this. It's awful. If you buy this issue, skip this story. Do yourself a favor and skip this story. Save yourself the bad news.
Wow.
It was awful. Wow. It was awful. I'm sure that's not the intention of the creators, but it's so bad. So it could be one of the worst things I've ever read. It's that bad.
Oh, my Lord.
So, rant over. Take it away, well, Rob.
It's a heck of a rant. I actually, out of all the three chapters, this is the third chapter in this Artemis story. I found this one, at least this one, had some action in it and had a point to it. It finally, as you said, it's time. I had no idea what the hell those first previous two chapters were tying into. It was just Artemis acting totally out of character, whining and crying in the sands of Egypt or wherever the hell she was. But, you know, I will say this about writer Dalia S. Dawson on this. She has the concept of what could be a much better story. I mean, the idea it's not just the United States against the Amazons. They were working internationally to try to build up, you know, some efforts against the Amazons. And so I understand them wanting to know where Themyscira is, to isolate Themyscira. And so the idea that the Americans or certain forces abroad in conjunction with America would also controlled by the Sovereign or Amanda Waller or whatever, that they would also want to know the location of the Banda Migdal Amazons. That makes sense. And if they located in the desert Artemis, well, of course, she's the prime target. Get Artemis, she'll lead you to the Banda Migdal. I get that. Also, but then why the hell aren't people looking for Yara Flor so they can find the Esquisita tribe in the Brazilian jungle? But that's, you know, they don't have enough real estate for that, nor enough comics that they're publishing. But so the fragments of a story that might be pretty cool are there, but ultimately nothing comes of it. So this is just a glorified fight between Artemis and an army. Well, guess what? I mean, I hate to say this, but we had a hell of a fight between Wonder Woman and the U.S. Army that no one's going to top. That was drawn by Daniel Samper, and that was amazing. And this is, I actually love Artemis, and with apologies to the artist on this one, I mean, it's not no Daniel Samper, but, you know, I don't mind her fighting, but it was a little bit over the top. I agree with you. This blind talking about the hatred that these American soldiers have, or in the desert. In fairness, it was already established the American soldiers, they don't hate. So I don't like that Artemis would assume they hate her. Well, actually, no, some of them don't. In fact, that was made quite clear that a lot of them didn't even want to fight Wonder Woman in the U.S. soil. And if they do hate her, at least attribute it to the Apples of Discord, incorporate some of Josie Campbell's storyline in the Amazon's attack to explain the hatred that Artemis might see. I don't like the suggestion that these American soldiers just hate for the sake of hate. It doesn't portray American soldiers in a particularly great light. I don't like it for that reason. In any event, it feels hollow. I do believe I'm going to give Delia Dawson the benefit of the doubt on this issue. At least this is a tie-in. I just wish it packed a little bit more punch. And as you said, we had two previous chapters here that so much organic development could have led to this moment. That was completely squandered with her talking to a snake and having a dream and whatever the hell that was in the previous two chapters. But in any event, it is a disappointment, although this third chapter for me was a miles step above the previous two chapters.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point about, well, you know, some of these other countries, it's not just the U.S. that are, you know, trying to get rid of the Amazons or what have you. And you're right, and it could be that, like I said, the U.S. military did get permission to go into whatever country she's in. Seems like it's somewhere in the Middle East and try to extract her. You know, that very well might be the case. But even so, even if that is the case, excuse me, they're still talking about enforcing the Amazon Extradition Act, which is an act which is specifically an American act. It's not enforceable in other countries. It doesn't matter. Even if that country says, yeah, you can come in here. You can go after her, you can capture her, you can do whatever you want. That's fine. They're giving you the authority to do that. But that has nothing to do with the Amazon Extradition Act, unless that country passed their own law, their own act, their own initiative, whatever you want to call it, and called it the same thing as the Americans, which no country in the history of the world has ever done that. They've passed similar laws, but they always call it something different, at least to my knowledge. Yeah. So, just a problematic story at best. But again, you know, nothing personal against the creators. I know they're, you know, doing their best. And this is not a creator that has, you know, a long track record. So hopefully if they do hear my criticism, they can, you know, use it as fuel and, do better in the future and probably never want to talk to me or give me an interview ever in their entire career. I don't need to go on, but it really got under my skin. So anyway, up next is the Swamp Thing story that I'm talking about. I have absolutely no idea what this has to do with anything with Batman. I mean, for that matter, what does the previous story have to do with Batman or the story before that at least had some Batman villains? This guy, he finds out that his company is dumping toxic waste in the swamp. And he goes out or they knock him out. They take him out to the swamp and they kill him. And then Swamp Thing finds him because he's dying and Swamp Thing senses his pain and what have you. And this definitely seems like the old school Swamp Thing, the Alec Holland Swamp Thing. Although the guy is dead, Swamp Thing kind of brings him down to the green and incorporates him into the green in some aspect, which lets his soul linger a little bit so that he can have a chance to see his loved ones come and say goodbye, even though they can't see him. I think it's supposed to be like this really heartfelt, mournful type story, but it kind of missed the mark for me. I kind of felt like it was a more of a what's the point type story. The art was okay, but ultimately just really forgettable, I think. It wasn't impactful for me anyway. What'd you think?
It was fine, actually. It actually reminded me a little bit of Cy Spurrier's story, at least in maybe metaphorically or symbolically in terms of how Swamp Thing can incorporate a death and make the most out of it through plant and through growth and through that, you know, of course, the resurrection and rebirth and that all life, you know, that this guy, this man's sacrifice, he never died in vain, that ultimately, I mean, Swamp Thing will carry on the cause and probably prevent these chemicals from causing substantial damage, perhaps in large part because of what he found out from this person who was this CEO that died. And then his family will have a chance to celebrate his life as he sort of is resurrected in the form of beautiful, you know, the, through the green. And so I thought it was a nice story. It was a nice story. So I didn't mind it. And I actually really, really loved the coloring, the colors and the art. I really liked it. The coloring in particular sort of popped off the page. I apologize. I don't know. The colorist is Mike Spicer, a parting gift. Yeah. No surprise. I shouldn't be surprised. Mike Spicer again. Every time there's great coloring, that guy's name often pops up. But yeah, it's good. It's nice. It's a beautiful tale.
All right. Last up, we have a black and white story where Batman's confronting a henchman who's like a lot of the henchmen in Gotham has worked for various villains, including Two-Face and the Penguin. And this guy, apparently his wife had a terminal illness that she didn't tell him about because she didn't want him pursuing a life of crime. And she didn't want to tell him about her illness because then she was worried that it would force him or the guy would, you know, feel even more obligated to pull jobs and do whatever to try to save her. So it's a bit of back and forth between this henchman and Batman. The henchman, you know, it's one of those things like a tiger can't change his stripes. Batman agrees to or basically says that they're even, right? At one point, this henchman tipped Batman off to a bomb that Two-Face had planted because the henchman was worried that some innocent children were going to be killed. And so with the tip, Batman was able to kind of save the day. Now he's returning the favor by telling this henchman, hey, there's a shipment coming in tomorrow for Penguin. And I'm going to be there and everybody who's there is going to, you know, get busted. So stay away, you know, consider us even now, you know, think about your late wife and what she would have wanted for you. But in the end, and then he leaves. And in the end, the henchman's like, oh, tomorrow she's going to be very, very proud of me. It's big score time. I'm going to hit the jackpot. And it ends with him kind of sitting on the couch. You know, he's still going to go. And he's got, you know, these delusions of grandeur, if you will, that thinks he's going to be able to put one over on Batman. So kind of an interesting take on the mentality of a henchman. So I thought it was a pretty strong story. What do you think? Yeah,
I agree with you. A very strong story. And you get into, I mean, like you say, it's the criminal mindset. And there's a reason why to say that old cliche, you know, Batman fights against the superstitious and cowardly lot. That's the criminal mindset. And you can't, you know, some, you know, leopards can't change their stripes or spots or whatever the hell it is. But is it, but no, this was very well done. Herrick Hanna, I'm not familiar with him as a writer, but this is a very good first impression on me. And yeah, I'd be interested to see, you know, this is interesting insight. I it was a little bit of a misdirection. That final page, that was good. That caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting that. And it was, I was expecting, sometimes I unfairly, I expect sort of a derivative. I don't expect much when I see a black and white, but when a black and white story sort of stands out, yeah, I actually thought this was one of the better stories in this particular issue of Brave and the Bold. I thought it was a pleasant surprise and very well done. And Herrick Hanna, I don't know if I'll have to Google his name. I don't know if he's written anything else, but, you know, I like the story and I'd like curious to hear more about from Herrick Hanna. And Charlie Adler's art I thought was quite good too.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And here's what that last page does, right? Because you sort of expect, and we would not have been surprised to see this story end with this guy kind of kneeling in his little shack in, you know, in the darkness with maybe, you know, one little spotlight on him. And he's kind of kneeling and hunched over and sort of defeated after Batman, you know, tells him, hey, I know you're trying to fool me, but I'm one step ahead of you. Don't show up tomorrow night. You'll get busted or whatever. And this guy would, you know, be small. He'd be small. He would be in a panel with a lot of empty space and what have you. And like I said, most of it would be black, a little light in the middle. And the guy would just be kind of kneeling there, hunched over, crying or weeping and just, oh, what a failure I am. And my wife would be so disappointed, whatever. And in that story, like who's the hero of that story? Who has all the agency in that story? Well, Batman does, because Batman like completely, thoroughly defeated and humiliated this guy to the point where the guy's not even going to show up to do his quote unquote job, not even going to show up to do his thing, be a henchman, right? That's the story that I would expect. We've seen those types of stories hundreds of times. With this last page and flipping around and this guy going, it's big score time and Batman's not going to scare him away or whatever. It totally flips it around and gives the agency to this henchman to say, you know, he might be busted, but he's going to go down swinging. Not saying it's right to go and commit crimes or whatever, but at least it's something different. At least it flips it around and gives agency, you know, and shows the Batman's not infallible. So, fantastic.
I actually interpreted it like your comments, but also there's another way to view it, and that is that in many ways the criminal throughout the story is humanized. Batman, through scolding him and getting one up on the criminal and telling him what you're going to do and warning him, he's sort of humanizing. We gain some sympathy for the criminal. We gain some sympathy for him, that, and then even Batman does. That's why Batman's sort of giving him that olive branch, saying, look, I'm going to give you a chance here. And then at the end, by putting on that mask on that final page, it's like we lose the connection. He's just another criminal now. It's like we went through all that. We finally got to some sympathy for this guy, and it's stripped away with that final panel, because he just won't let himself do the right thing. And it's like you said, there's that phrase that we hate using because it's so, but that subverting of expectation. It's exactly what it does on the final page in a good effect.
Yeah, in a very good way. So, all right, up next, The Flash number 8, written by Simon Spurrier, art by Ramon Perez and Vasco Gregev, colors by Sophie Dodgson and Matt Herms, letters by Hassan Osman Elhal. I'm going to let you go first here in the attempt to not have another rant. I'll try to keep any ranting I have to a minimum.
Yeah. For cover of the week, I'm certainly going to give it to Power Girl number 8 with Crush on the cover. I really like that. I just love that cover. For this cover of Flash number 8, I think this has to be my winner so far for 2024. This is the ugliest, pointless, most ridiculous, boring, phone it in, and if you told me an AI did this cover, I'd believe you. I don't think AI could be this bad. This was phoned in, absolutely phoned in, horrible cover. And I mean, nothing to do with the content, just another stupid pose with the Flash symbol. I guess whoever the artist was, Perez had, I guess he only had 10 minutes to draw something, and somebody had a red and yellow crayon set, and boom, off to the races they went. But anyways, that's my rant about the cover. Now, as for the story, well, buckle up. Could I go on this sucker? But let's just say once again, if I didn't know better, part of me is thinking maybe there's a part of Cy Spurrier is listening, although I know he isn't, because he said he doesn't listen to criticism in the last interview I heard him give. I'm not sure if that was with you or somebody else, but in any event, he basically, this issue is, at least it's being spelled out that there's cracks in time, and there's dimensional disasters that are occurring all over the world, and there's time storms, and dimensional distortions are happening all over the world, and the Flashes, the entire Flash family is all over the world, from Circuit Breaker to Flash Wally. They're trying to find Wally, but then Barry's trying to get a handle on things, and then we got Avery and Wallace West, and everyone's trying to battle all this. Meanwhile, Jay is what's his face? Jay is in a kitchen talking to Inspector Pilgrim, and this guy named Uncle Hartley shows up, who visits Jay. He's looking for Wally. Meanwhile, Iris is given is on a radio talk show, and she's defending superheroes against the people who are on the side of Amanda Waller, that, you know, superheroes need to be reined in. And throughout the issue, I found it a little bit confusing, because we got very interesting visuals. Ramon Perez and Vasco Gregev on the art. I thought the art was even actually quite good at times, but there's dinosaurs, and there's different creatures and crazy things appearing all over the earth. I think because time is distorting, because there's the Speed Force is all wonky now, that a bunch of chaos is happening. And the problem is that I have no idea whenever the speedsters are on the page, there's one page in particular where it shows, it literally shows Jesse Quick, Wallace West, Barry Allen, and Avery, and they're literally just running around, but I don't know what they're doing. All of a sudden, a giant spider appears, then a dinosaur. But how are they stopping all this? Like, they kind of admit that there's nothing they can do with all this stuff that's happening with the dimensions breaking down, and Amanda Waller's making it clear that this is all the speedster's fault. By the way, how does Amanda Waller know it's the speedster's fault? Does Amanda Waller actually know about the arc angles, and does Amanda Waller actually know about those, about the uncoiled? How on earth would she possibly know about any of that? None of that makes any sense to me. Meanwhile, I think suddenly the rogues are working for the arc angles, these arc angles, and because Gorilla Grodd takes over Barry Allen's mind at the end again, and Barry Allen, in conjunction with the Mirror Master, is fighting Barry Allen and trying, and I'm not really sure what it is they're doing. I'm not sure what their purpose is or their motive is. At first, at the end, I thought that maybe the Crown of Thrawns showed up again, but it can't be. They don't even mention the Crown of Thrawns, which, again, we don't know what that is, the Crown of Thrawns. I think it's just Gorilla Grodd took over Barry's mind. Meanwhile, Iris gets into an argument. Amanda Waller shows up at the radio station of all places to argue with Iris Allen. This is ridiculous. I know that you got to have a crossover with the events of Absolute Power, but I thought this was just messier than hell. And in a story that is wonky to begin with, and then Inspector Pilgrim apparently knows Uncle Hartley, hints at knowing who he is and meeting him for the first time. The whole thing just seems so, I'm not sure what's really going on, and I'm more frustrated and annoyed. I was far more annoyed reading this than I was reading the Artemis story in Batman Brave and the Bold, to the extent that that annoyed you, that story. This one really annoyed me. I mean, I kind of sort of got what's going on here, but I'm still confused as to what. Okay, the speedsters, we know that the speedsters are being rounded up by Inspector Pilgrim because he doesn't want them to run around all over the place. Well, Amanda Waller spreading the rumors now that the speedsters are causing the disruptions in the Speed Force, and Amanda Waller is actually right about that. But you'd think Amanda Waller would be a little bit concerned about that, because Amanda Waller, here's the thing with what Amanda Waller's doing right now. She is spreading propaganda, spreading lies about the heroes, but she's actually not lying about the speedsters causing a disruption in the Speed Force. She's actually right about that. But does she actually know she's right about that? Or does she's just doing it because it's propagandizing? I'm not sure where this is going. At the end of this issue, it's going to be continued in Flash 2024 Annual. It seems to me that the rogues are working in conjunction with the Arc Angles, which has an agenda to, I don't know, destroy the Speed Force. But for what purpose? Why do the rogues want to destroy the Speed Force? Why are they attacking Barry and then Wally? I don't really understand what the agenda or the motives of the rogues are. I know the rogues always like to cause disruptions with Wally West, but I'm not sure what their agenda is here, other than just, okay, defeating. Why do they care about the Speed Force? Why would they risk destroying the world by disrupting the Speed Force? Why are the rogues doing that? Why are they working with the Arc Angles? At least I think they are. Maybe I got that wrong. I'm embarrassed to say I read this three times, and I'm sure you're going to correct me on some of the things I misapprehended. But I was confused, and I like the parts with Jay and Inspector Pilgrim, but I still don't quite understand how that fits in with the larger narrative, and I don't really know what the rogues are doing or why. What the Crown of Thrawns, which never even showed up in this issue, what that has to do with anything. So this issue was a big question mark for me. And uh, my my final criticism, aside from the very disappointing cover, my criticism with respect to the art remains that there is a terrible, terrible correlation between whatever Cy Spurrier wants the art to convey, it's not working. There's that expression, show, don't tell. There's no way you can show me what's going on when this involves comic book science that I'm not even sure Cy Spurrier knows what's going on. And it's, if you're going to create comic book science with arc angles and the uncoiled and all these new laws of physics or even existing laws of physics, at least be consistent or show how there's consistency. And remember that not every reader has a PhD in physics or even a BA. And in any event, my rant is over now, my friend.
That was definitely a mild rant compared to mine. I would say that you pretty much got everything right. There's nothing that you misunderstood. Although you're mentioning how does Amanda Waller know? So they did serve a warrant at Terrifitech, and that was the whole reason that Hartley, who you know Pied Piper, who's been reformed, is now a scientist, whatever, works with Michael Holt, Mr. Terrific.
Okay, right.
And the whole reason he went looking for Wally. Was because he knew that the research they're doing at Terrifitech to try to find out how the speedster is using their power and how them accessing the speed force is causing all this stuff. He knew once that Amanda Waller's organization went in there and served the warrant, they were going to have access to that research and they were going to have proof that the speedsters were causing the problem. So she does have actual proof. Now, that's not to say that she's correct in what she does. Like she calls the podcast, she threatens the podcast host and Iris West with being arrested for spreading terrorist propaganda. Like again, it's similar to you know what we saw in the pages of the Artemis story. It's so absolutely 100% ludicrous. It's so despicable. It's so disingenuous, and yeah, very much meta, right? And the frustrating thing that we have where there's this thing that happened probably starting in, 2015 or so when a certain someone was running for president where it no longer mattered if you were telling the truth. The truth became this subjective thing and you can have empirical evidence and you can show somebody, exactly what's happening and show them something that's 100% true. Grass is green and you're pointing to it and you're showing it to them in 85 different ways. You're analyzing it scientifically. And their response is, well, I just don't believe that's true. And where do you go? Where do you go when somebody says that? Like, there's nowhere to go. Like, there's going to be a certain segment of the population that's just going to believe whatever they want to believe. And no matter what you tell them and what evidence you give them or what have you, all it does is it makes them, believe what they believe even more, right? Like, they don't want to admit they're wrong, that you're just entrenching them in standing up for misinformation and what have you. And that's Amanda Waller. Like she cares nothing about what the actual truth is. She only cares about her agenda. And that's what she's pushing here. Now, here's the thing, like as nonsensical as this Flash series has been so far with all the scientific gobbledygook and what have you, at least that nonsense, like it was nonsense for in a different way, right? Like Spurrier was trying to tell his story. Yeah, kind of derivative, something wrong with the Speed Force, seeing that story a bunch of times with the Mike Diodato art being kind of esoteric. It was really leaning into that feeling of, man, I don't know what the hell is going on. The kind of the worst thing that you can do with a nonsensical story like that is bring in a completely different story that's off to the side, that's completely separate. And Amanda Waller hasn't been a part of this, but we know how nonsensical her opinions are. Her and Logic have never even been in the same room when it comes to her opinion on superheroes. Now you bring in that complete nonsense and throw it in with this. Now you got two nonsensical storylines, two nonsensical plots vying for our attention. And I'm supposed to care about what happens in this issue? I'm supposed to, it's not really possible for me to be any more annoyed by Amanda Waller at this point. You know, she just is what she is. I mean, if I'm Cy Spurrier, there's no way he gets away with this, right? There's no way it sees print. But how would you like it if the podcast host just snapped and says, hey, problem solved, pulls out a gun and just blows Amanda Waller's head off? Problem solved. We can move on from absolute power and just get on to the absolute universe now, right? Problem solved. You know, absolute power can just be, okay, Brainiac and Failsafe need to be defeated. All right, we're done. Again, would never happen. It's nice to dream, but yeah, I mean, I don't know what we're doing here. I don't know what we're doing here, like with Flash. Like, yeah. Just when you think you can't get, when it can't make less sense, we bring in the whole absolute power storyline, which, you know, again, we did the absolute power preview when all the information got announced, and, you know, we're hoping that they're going to be able to redeem Waller in some way and make it make sense. And, you know, at least we'll get some cool stories or whatever. But, you know, at the heart of it, when it comes to Amanda Waller, she's become a nonsensical character and has been for a long time. We talk about her just being a plot device at this point. The last place she needs to show up is a story that's already struggling to make sense. So I don't blame Cy Spurrier whatsoever. Like, this feels 100% editorially mandated, in my opinion. Like, yeah, he's like, well, the Flash, Barry Allen, Wally West, they exist in the DC universe. The whole DC universe is going to lose their superpowers. You gotta mention it. You gotta bring it in. So that's what they did. To the detriment of Cy Spurrier's story, unfortunately, it didn't need any more strikes against it. But unfortunately, it got one this week. So, and yeah, I agree with you on the art. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say that's the ugliest cover I've ever seen, or whatever. Whatever you said.
Well, no, since beginning of the year for me, it's the worst one from DC at the beginning of the year since January.
It's pretty bad. Like, part of what I don't like about it, like, that doesn't even look like his lightning bolt. It looks like an N. Like, the little zigzag goes too far down on the So anyway, whatever. It's not a good cover. all right. Up next we have The Penguin number 9, good old Bruce. Tom King is the writer, Rafael De La Torre on art, Marcelo Mayala on colors, Clayton Cowell on letters. I'm gonna let you go first on this one as well. I have a sneaking feeling that you probably enjoyed this issue more than me. I definitely don't have a rant here. I have a nitpick that I'll bring up. We'll see if you bring it up as well. But definitely not one of the stronger issues of Penguin in my mind. But before you do give us your thoughts on it, though, one thing that I realized might have been last week, the week before, or maybe it was after the last time we reviewed a Penguin book. You know, one thing that we haven't mentioned at all in the idea of DC wanting to make, or it seems like they want to make the Penguin more formidable, return him to his more villainous roots, as opposed to having him be kind of jokey, you know, top hat, you know, tux with tails and cigarette holder and what have you. There's the show coming, right? I think it's on Max, starring the version of the Penguin from the Matt Reeves movie with
Colin Farrell. Colin Farrell as Penguin.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if their idea kind of, if editorial took some cues from that and says, hey, you know, we need to make the Penguin a little more of a badass. I mean, I haven't seen the Matt Reeves Batman movie, so I don't know how much of a badass he is. But although I've had people that have told me their favorite part of the Matt Reeves movie was the Penguin. So anyway, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, this chapter, chapter 9, Penguin issue 9, is called Good Old Bruce. And I'm not sure why it's called Good Old Bruce, but I will say that the detective, Batman, the detective, Batman absolutely believes that the Penguin is setting up his own children and trying to blame his children for all this terrorism that's happening in Gotham City. And of course, the Penguin is behind everything, but the Penguin is masterfully pulling the wool over Batman's eyes. And the Penguin almost, and I think this is going to be a criticism of some people who think that this is, you know, Batman can fall from a moon. And okay, with some criticism, but if Batman can survive a fall from the moon, and we call him Uber Batman, right? This is probably as close as you're going to come to Uber Penguin. I mean, Penguin manages to really pull the wool over Batman, and Batman, right to the bitter end, just can't believe that Penguin is not behind all these terrorist acts. But Penguin has got every aspect of it. Penguin has Lieutenant Espinosa, the swear, the that FBI agent who's constantly swearing. So he's got the feds basically in his pocket, and the feds is feeding Jim Gordon false information, leading him to believe that it's Aiden and Addison Cobblepot that are behind everything after taking over Gotham from their father, Oswald Cobblepot, the Penguin. And all the forensic work seems to come back. Penguin's managed to even all the forensic detective work that Batman is doing all leads Batman to conclude that this is absolutely, that Penguin is not lying to him. And Batman has, you know, basically is holding Penguin over the side of a building saying, you're supposed to give me information and you're behind this, aren't you? And no, it's not. Penguin is basically, he's sticking to his guns. And Penguin's lover, Lisa St. Clair, is even in on it. And she's telling Bruce Wayne, lets it leak to Bruce Wayne that she's being blackmailed by the twins, by Aiden and Addison Cobblepot. And so again, every bit of information that Batman is getting from every single source, even sources that you would think Cobblepot would not be aware of, is leading Batman to believe that, goddamn, Oswald is telling me the truth. And yet we know that's not the case, and it isn't the case. And Penguin has done some really horrible things here. He blows up Martha Wayne's child care center, which was a particular, I mean, it was obviously, it's Bruce Wayne's mother, and I mean that center means a lot to him. And even the Black Spider, who we met in a previous issue, the Black Spider is sent in to basically intentionally let himself to, the Black Spider is sent to plant a bomb in a civilian center and deliberately walk in front of a camera so that it's obvious. Black Spider just does what he's told. Black Spider wants revenge against Aiden and Addison Cobblepot. So that's why he's working with Oswald. He's working with the Penguin because he hates the twins. He hates Oswald's kids, and he wants to be the one to kill them. And so Black Spider blindly does what Oswald tells him to do, and he lets himself get caught by Batman. Then he tells Batman he blames it on the twins when it's the cause of Cobblepot's. Every aspect of this is to set up and make it look like the twins, that the Penguin's children are behind everything. And but there's more character work here. I love the dialogue, the conversation between Lisa St. Clair and Bruce Wayne. And by the way, I didn't realize, because I just plain plumb forgot, I didn't know that Lisa St. Clair's sister was Silver St. Clair. I actually confused the two. So I appreciate that clarification. But I love how Lisa St. Clair, at one point in this story, she gives dialogue here that I thought was just so funny. She talks about how disgusted she is, as she talks about how when she's having sex with Cobblepot, she's disgusted by the first time she had sex with him, she had to go into the shower and shower the stench off her. But there was something about it the smell of lilac as she got out of the shower that would make him, she would, despite being disgusted by him, she would pick up the phone and call Oswald back. And it shows the desperation. This is how desperate Lisa St. Clair is for power. She'll disgust herself. She'll lower herself to sleep with the Penguin just to get an ounce of that power that the Penguin has, because she appreciates his power. And meanwhile, the Penguin's desperation is seen in the depths to which he will allow himself being humiliated by Batman, by being hit by the Batman, humiliated by Batman. Look at all the humiliations that Penguin has subjected himself to, being beat up by every mobster imaginable, being a lowly three and a half foot bartender who looks ugly, is downtrodden, is looked down upon. Everybody beats up on Oswald Cobblepot. He is willing to degrade himself repeatedly because he knows that at the end he's doing it all for power, and that power will eventually come to him, and that's exactly what it does. And so I could see through the disgust that Lisa St. Clair has for Cobblepot, yet she's drawn to him, and how Oswald is willing to debase himself to get the power. They're both desperate for power, and they express that desperation in different ways, and you can almost see how they're attracted to each other. And that was brilliantly done, and that's all in this issue by Tom King. I thought the dialogue was great. I loved the conversations between Batman and Jim Gordon. Jim Gordon is outright convinced. Is telling Batman, look, man, hey, Oswald's behind this, or pardon me, the twins are behind this. I mean, that's what all the evidence points to. What can I tell you? This is what the feds say. Anyways, I thought this was really well done. And then at the end, you see once again, you see the crack in the armor of Cobblepot. Despite Oswald's willing to debase himself and to make so many sacrifices, and yet at the end, there's a suggestion here that his true love, he's only willing to show willingly show weakness, not part of a game when he's being debased by others. And that's with Rita. And we first met Rita. She's the woman in Metropolis that he was married to. It appears perhaps that Rita is actually his true love because he's willing to be vulnerable in front of her. And he tells Lieutenant Espinoza, the FBI agent Espinoza, that he wants to talk to Rita. And Rita is the reason why the FBI has Rita in the back of their van is because they apprehended her. That's their leverage that they have over Cobblepot, is that they've got her on sort of trumped up charges. You know that Oswald ultimately will probably want to save her or get her out of the clutches of the FBI. How is he going to do that? Is Rita even going to survive this series? Who knows? But honestly, I love this issue. I thought this was so well done, and everything is coming to a head, even with that, because remember what Batman said in issue one at the last panel of issue one, Oswald, how did you do this? So this is the story of how Oswald Cobblepot pulled off something and even pulled the wool over Batman's eyes, and he did it. Now, if you're not a fan of Uber Penguin, because we don't see a lot of Uber Penguin, you're not going to like this. If you're tired of Batman always losing and you don't think that Penguin could ever pull the wool over Batman's eyes, you're probably not going to enjoy this. But I, for one, think it's a long time coming. I like this. I like this new Penguin. I think this is the best. I've never been more interested in the Penguin or found him more interesting than I have the way Tom King is scripting him right now, straight up. I think it's fantastic. I like what John Ridley did in Penguin One Bad Day. And I think that's in many ways, I think that sort of ties into this, at least story-wise in different elements of it, in terms of what Penguin's willing to do, in terms of Batman's uncomfortable yet necessary relationship with the Batman, the way they sort of play off each other. And I don't know, I quite enjoyed this. I thought the art was good. I thought the art set the tone, the coloring, the dialogue, everything. This was a big hit for me. I'm talking about it now. This is definitely one of my candidates for pick of the week this week, along with the other one I mentioned that I've, which was Detective Comics. So yeah, it's going to be a tough pick for me here, but what do you think?
Well, I'm kind of one of those who doesn't like Uber Penguin. it's so funny. You're talking about, Batman jumping from the moon, Uber Batman, whatever. And now we have Uber Penguin. Okay. Well, let's take a Batman that can jump from the moon and survive. Let's take a Batman who we're beat over the head with Batman being the world's greatest detective. This guy can figure out everything, right? So the Penguin has, as you said, covered all his bases. You did a great job of summing it up, saying, every source Batman goes to, even sources he thinks the Penguin would know about, they're all telling him the same thing. Even sources that he thinks the Penguin wouldn't know about, they're all telling him the same thing. They're all pointing the finger at his kids, right? They're all saying, yeah, it's the kids that did this. They're the ones that, set up all these bombings. They're the ones that are still in charge of Gotham City. They're the ones that are causing all this. The Penguin's, really has retired and isn't looking to be involved and all that sort of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. That's what, everything that Batman, every time that, Batman turns around, that's where everybody's pointing. It's Aiden and it's Addison. It's Aiden and it's Addison. Except for his gut, right? His gut, obviously, the reason he's pursuing this from so many different angles is because his gut is telling him it's got to be the Penguin. It's got to be the Penguin. So in a way, Batman is more aware of Uber Penguin and understands what the Penguin is capable of, like maybe better than anybody. And so that's why his gut is telling him that. Whereas everything else is saying, no, it's the kids, it's Aiden and Addison and what have you. But here's the thing. With the Batman that can jump from the moon, with the Batman that's the world's greatest detective, that we're beaten over the head with or whatever, I think he would be able to have figured out that this was a setup. It's not like he went out, the Penguin really went out of the way. I mean, look at the Black Spider scene. Like, in my mind, the Black Spider, like, he's more formidable than that. He's more capable than that. To me, that goes the other way and tells me, no, this is a false flag operation. The fact that the Black Spider would let himself be filmed, let himself be videoed planting the bomb, he knows he can avoid cameras if he wants to. So in a way, it's almost like a triple take for me, right? Like, you think if it's too obvious, well, first of all, you're presented with the facts, your perceived the facts are. And the facts are saying it's Addison and Aiden, right? Those are the facts. But it's so much evidence and it's so over the top and it's, so obvious that you got to think it can't be that obvious. It has to be a setup. Somebody is setting them up. But then you can flip it around and go, maybe that's what they want me to think. And now it's three layers now, right? But here's the thing. It's Batman. He's the world's greatest detective. You tell me you can't figure this shit out? And I'm glad you brought up the very first scene that we had where it's Batman and Penguin in the car with Batman saying in the Batmobile and Batman saying to the Penguin, how did you do this? Which leads me to believe that the Penguin is going to be successful at the end of the day. Maybe he doesn't get away with it. Maybe Batman captures him, but he's at least successful in whatever it is that he's trying to do, to the point where Batman's not able to stop whatever that catastrophe or disaster or whatever it might be. This really is the Uber Penguin, and it is Batman failing, which don't get me wrong. I don't have a problem with Batman failing and Batman not being, the end all be all most powerful, smartest guy in the DC universe, whatever, except that's what we're always sold. That's what DC Comics is always telling us. That's what so many stories in recent DC history have told us, that Batman, Batman always wins. Batman always wins, time and time again. Look at the Batman Fortress story that we had recently. Batman always wins. That's what we're supposed to think. But now we're getting a story where Batman doesn't win. And all I'm saying is you can't have it both ways. Either give us a story where Batman that always wins, he's tenacious and he's not going to give up until he wins, or say that Batman's capable of losing. Now, again, don't get me wrong. I don't mind that. In fact, I would prefer a Batman that loses from time to time because it makes for more interesting and diverse stories. But that's not what we've gotten over the last, 20 years. So that's kind of the problem that I'm having here. Like, this issue sort of makes Batman look like a dumbass in a lot of ways. Yeah, I get that the facts are pointing in one direction, but Batman's supposed to be better than that. The facts as presented are sending him in one direction. But when you talk about actual facts, the actual truth, the world's greatest detective should be able to find the truth. Maybe he just hasn't gotten there yet. Maybe he will in the next issue. But as I was reading this, I was like, well, Penguin did this and Batman fell for it. Penguin did this and Batman fell for it. But again, the saving grace that in his gut, he doesn't believe it, but he is buying into all the facts as presented. So that's, again, it's a nitpick. The story's not over. We still have a couple issues to go. We'll see how it all plays out. And I think it is still a really good story. I thought the art was solid as it's been throughout this issue. And at the end of the day, I think the series is doing exactly what DC wanted it to do, which is, like I said at the beginning, making a more formidable Penguin. Whether that's to tie in with other properties or not can be debated, but it's succeeding on that level of making the Penguin feel dangerous. So, all right. Up next, we have Green Arrow, issue number 11 from writer Joshua Williamson, art by Sean Isaacs, Phil Hester, and Eric Gapster. Colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., letters by Troy Petrie. This is as by the numbers as it can get. We know that Oliver found Wally at this fortress in Antarctica, and they're there to steal the map. Now, why all the information from Sanctuary would be stored in a Sanctuary mask? I don't know why that would actually be the case, other than story reasoning. It's right up there with the plans for the Death Star in the super advanced far future
Yeah.
Civilization being stored on an actual physical hard drive. That yeah. they have to get. That's not how it would be. They wouldn't be stored on actual. But anyway, it just doesn't make sense. But of course, Wally and Oliver managed to steal it. Of course, they managed to fight off the hard light constructs of the Justice League with the help of the rest of the Green Arrow family, as it were. And then, of course, at the end of the day, Ollie tricks sends all the other members of the Green Arrow family away and gets Amanda Waller to send him where he wants to go, which is basically he wants revenge on Malcolm Merlyn for trying to keep the Green Arrow family apart. That's basically the gist of the story. So there's not a lot that happens here. There's a little kind of interlude in the middle that sort of gives the history of Malcolm Merlyn and specifically the history of Malcolm Merlyn and Oliver Queen together, which was kind of nice and gives context for people that aren't that familiar with their backstory. And then at the end, sort of at the end of time in the far future where Malcolm Merlyn was stranded earlier in this run, he's managed to make a lot of hard light constructs. It appears to be hard light constructs of all the different members of the Green Arrow family himself that Oliver Queen is going to have to battle against. And what's cool is it's not just like, okay, he's got to fight against Black Canary. He's got to fight against, Connor Hawk. He's got to fight against Arsenal, whatever. It's a bunch of different iterations. So you get to see some old school costumes from some of these. You get to see the Arsenal costume where he had the purple and it was like a crossbow on his wrist. You get to see the old school Black Canary costume where she had kind of the wings coming out of her shoulders and the black headband. That was like pure Jane Fonda 1980s costume. So you get to see all these different previous iterations of these characters that he's going to Oliver Queen's going to have to fight against. So looking forward to seeing that. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say for 1 second that Oliver's not going to win the day. Of course he is. Of course he's going to beat all those hard light constructs, even though he looks like he's outnumbered like 25-1. And of course he's going to defeat Malcolm Merlyn as well. And then he's going to come back to the regular time and he's going to prevent Amanda Waller from accessing that sanctuary information. Why and how does it seem like he's going to be able to do all that when he doesn't even have superpowers? Well, because reasons, because the comic's called Green Arrow. That's why. So of course all of that's going to happen. But hopefully it'll be a fun ride along the way. I thought the art was really strong in this as well. So again, very much by the numbers storytelling here. We're not getting any plot twists. We're not treading any new ground here, but it has its moments, especially that final double page spread with all the different versions of these Green Arrow adjacent characters. So, not the most innovative comic, not the most memorable, but yeah, it's fun. And I thought the art was really solid. So what are your thoughts about it, Rocky?
I think I sang Joshua Williamson's praises last week on Superman. And, I remember Joshua Williamson gave more than a few interviews about talking up his Green Arrow, about he clearly had something to say about the character. And I couldn't imagine more empty first 11 issues. I mean, this is just I think there's just a stunning lack of character moments. I mean, there was the best moments were between Arsenal and Leon, and we that's to me that's the centerpiece ought to be the centerpiece. I'm sad to say that Arsenal and Leon that storyline is going to be playing out, and it has to play out in the pages of this series because that's an arc that for years, for a decade, we wanted Leon to return, and what happened to Arsenal, and Cheshire, that story, and that's what I'm so interested in. I'm not a Green Arrow fan to begin with, and boy oh boy, he's not a family man. This entire family feels forced. I say again, and this story is absolutely empty. And my God, we already got Merlyn in issue 6. Why are we going back to him again? Are you serious? I mean. This series could have ended at issue 6. None of this is necessary. We could have left Merlyn lost in time. Who cares? But if you're going to have another 6 issues after the first arc and you're going to revisit Merlyn, really?
We've already done this already. Just empty. But you know, look, the art's fantastic. By the three artists, I got to say, Isaac, Hester, and forgive me, Ivic Hester and Gapster, they did a good job collaborating. And even though they got their different artists, they did a good job. Like, artistically, this is a really fantastic issue. Artistically, visually, this, you know, I really enjoyed just paging through it. But there's just no story here. All the Green Arrow family shows up, and for some reason, there's something about a bunch of people with bows and arrows that they seem more redundant than the Bat family. But it just seems to so odd to me that Oliver just sends Roy off. No, basically, go to Leon. I gotta find Merlin. And okay, but it just feels like I don't care if he stops Merlin. I don't care if Merlin's lost in time. I mean, Merlin even said in this issue, well, I knew all I had to do was just stay where I am and eventually Waller or you would come for me. And incidentally, how old is Merlin? Doesn't the guy age? I mean, the guy was 20 years older than, I think he's 15, 20. He was 20 years older than Oliver to begin with when he gave his origin. Now he spent, how many years did he spend lost in time? Another 20? Like, what is he, 120 now? He doesn't age a day and he's got a scarred face. It just seemed odd to me. So, I don't know. I'm sort of nitpicking here. I just, again, visually, it was an eye-catching issue. I thought it was really good. I'm not normally a Phil Hester fan, but he did his pages here. There's a couple of full page spreads by Phil Hester that I think maybe some of his best work. I'm quite impressed with it. But story wise, this is empty. I review these, but I haven't bought a physical copy since issue 3. I called it. This has been an empty series. Nothing's happening. And you're absolutely right about Sanctuary. I mean, all that stuff caught in the mask itself. So ridiculous. And talk about an empty cliffhanger. He's fighting a bunch of light constructs. Like, he's not going to defeat a bunch of holograms. Come on. There's nothing at stake even at the end of this. And then next issue, here's a prediction what's going to happen in issue 12. It's going to be 2/3 of the issue, more than that. It'll be, if it's 30 pages long, it'll be 28 pages of Green Arrow fighting a bunch of light constructs. He'll get back and it'll be 2 pages and one panel with Roy holding his daughter. Which, when it should be like, and so it's going to be disappointing. I just know it. And I will happily put my foot in my mouth if I end up being wrong on that, but I'm not going to be wrong on that. So my rant is over.
Yeah, I mean, fingers crossed. Yeah. But yeah, I have a feeling you're not wrong. So anyway, let's move on. Harley Quinn number 39, written by Tinney Howard. Natasha Bustos handles the art on this one. Nick Filardi on colors, Steve Wan's on letters. You know, I was pretty excited last issue when we were going in a different direction with Harley Quinn, finally, where she's trying to talk to different villains and try to get to the nature of their psychosis. She's like offering herself as kind of working as a henchman for them, so she can sort of psychoanalyze them as they're pulling off jobs. Unfortunately, she starts after being rebuffed by Mr. Freeze, which that would have been interesting. She ends up teaming up with Maxi Zeus. Maxi Zeus, who's got to be one of the most boring Batman villains, just the guy's off his rock. Like, it would be interesting with Mr. Freeze because you can kind of understand his motivations, right? Like, he wants to save his wife, but not really. It's more about him and his huge ego, what have you. Again, the Batman One Bad Day Mr. Freeze issue was absolutely fantastic in kind of exploring that. It would have been fun to have Harley's analysis of that, not her zany analysis, but the more serious Harley, like actually digging into that and some back and forth with Mr. Freeze. But he rebuffs her and she goes to Maxi Zeus, which I can't think of a worse villain to go with. Like, I can psychoanalyze Maxi Zeus right now. The guy's clinically insane. He believes he's a Roman god. Like, there's nothing, there's no back and forth. There's nothing interesting there. There's nothing relatable. The guy's just crazy. And so this just ends up feeling like fluff. And with the Natasha Bustos art, which is, she has a more juvenile art style, it also lends to the feeling of this being kind of, like, I can't take it seriously. I can't take this seriously at all.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not supposed to. Maybe, it is supposed to just be, oh, that crazy Harley Quinn. Oh, you know, this is just kind of nonsensical or whatever. But I was looking forward to like actually digging into some like serious, interesting back and forth between Harley and some different supervillains. And that's not what this is at all. Not to mention, you know, DC's done all this work to make Harley into a straight up hero, not even an anti-hero, but just a straight up hero. But when she shows up, when she meets Maxi Zeus or runs into Maxi Zeus for the first time here, she blatantly helps him escape, blatantly, you know, disobeys lawful orders from the Gotham City Police Department. And when the lieutenant or whatever, whoever she is from the Gotham City Police Department shows up at Harley Quinn's classroom the next day, she doesn't arrest her. She's like, and Harley's like, I wasn't there. I'm like, what are you talking about? There's 30 eyewitnesses that you were there. Like, if this was actual reality, the woman would be like, stand up, put your hands behind your back. You're under arrest. You broke the law, you know? So, you know, and not to mention she's on probation. So it lacks any sort of verisimilitude. I know you love that word. This is just, I don't even know what to say at this point. Like, it pivoted away from the whole multiverse and you know, we could kind of understand why things would get zany when you're jumping through different dimensions and, you know, you got the zoo crew and whatever. You know, I could buy all that and with the brother's eyes and all that. But again, I thought we were pivoting to maybe a little bit more of a serious story. And instead, we got that for like 3/4 of an issue. And now we're back to complete and utter nonsense. So, I was disappointed. I was disappointed. Again, it's not a technically bad comic. It's well paced. The art is good, you know, for what it is. It just doesn't suit the story that I thought we were getting. Maybe it suits the story that Tinney Howard wants to write. Unfortunately, that's not a story that I'm particularly interested in. Again, I was so excited. I was so excited to dig in and have some serious, at least semi-serious Harley Quinn. Mm. But this is as non-serious Harley Quinn as almost as you can get. I mean, the only other way it could be less serious would be, you know, leaning into more of the dream sequence type Harley stuff that we've been getting in the backups, which, you know, I don't buy these physically, so it's not costing me an extra dollar. But these backups are a grift. You can't charge an extra dollar for these terrible backups of, in this case, it's a Poison Ivy dream. But who cares? It doesn't, they don't matter. They're not ever going to have any sort of consequence, right? Sometimes they might be fun, like the sort of the Harley Conan the Barbarian type one. Maybe that's fun, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It's just a way for you, DC to, or Warner Brothers Discovery, really, they're the ones that are mandating, just to kind of steal an extra dollar from their Harley Quinn fans. I don't think that's okay. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth. So anyway, maybe you have a different opinion. Doesn't sound like it, but what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I never had any expectations going into this. I expected it to be bad because I thought the premise was ridiculous last issue, and it remains so. I don't think there's enough lipstick to apply to any pig that could make this story possess any degree of verisimilitude. This is Harley Quinn. She's on probation, and part of the terms of her probation is to teach a class. That is, I mean, but instead she but. So she's violated probation and is if the cop doesn't recognize her, that it's Harley Quinn when she's dressed like Harley Quinn, sounds like Harley Quinn and helps Zeus or Maxi Zeus, whatever, get away with helping a criminal escape. And not only that, Robin, she confronts Robin and Robin knows that she's up to no good and Robin doesn't seem to care. And he just gives her a verbal warning. This is just, we're two white guys, you know, complaining about a Harley Quinn comic. So, I mean, I guess it's supposed to be a joke. It's supposed to be, but there's nothing, you know, quite frankly, this is how I would have approached it. You know, it's still a bad way to approach it, but it's better than this. We just finished a questionable sanctuary story in the pages of Green Arrow. If you were to tell me that Harley Quinn wanted to create a secret sanctuary for supervillains that need help but don't want to do it in the context of Arkham Asylum, or they don't want to do it in the conventional way because they don't want the good guys, they don't want government officials to know of their state of mind, and they want to do it covertly and basically have a villain's sanctuary just for villains, and that Harley Quinn may be putting together that behind the scenes, doing something serendipitous behind the scenes. And as crazy as that sounds, at least that would be kind of fun, and she'd have to pull the wool over the eyes of Batman and the Bat family, and you can go be a little zany on that and maybe go with that. But this is, I just I don't know. I agree with you. This whole thing is sort of like, I just sort of shake my head. And that's all I got to say about that. I do want to give a compliment, though. I actually like the backup, Quinzel Cosmic Corsair by Erica Henderson. I actually like, you know, I agree with you that it's sort of a pointless backup, but at least it reminded me a little bit, if you're going to have pointless backups, I'd rather have an entire comic of, it reminds me a little bit of Spy versus Spy, Mad Magazine. I used to love that, you know, give me stupid, over-the-top, clearly zany, insane Harley, maybe one or two page nonsense stories for 30 pages. I'd rather have that than what we're getting with long main stories, particularly that multiverse saga, which I just think, God, I thought that was going to go on forever. But I like Erica Henderson. I actually like she's got an eclectic style of art. I do actually have, I got a long Squirrel Girl run there. I actually enjoyed that. So maybe that's just a little quirk I have, but I didn't mind it. I did. So I preferred the backup. And I want to give a shout out to the actual cover B by Jenny Frison. Looks pretty good. You know that Harley Quinn is always good for at least one good looking variant cover, even though that's kind of my pet peeve. I don't mind it. A very strange cover C, which is, I think, the 1 in 25. I don't know who the cover artist is, but I think it's supposed to be a play on the Spider-Man No More with a bunch of raccoons eating Harley Quinn's costume, which is in the back of a garbage truck as Harley runs after it. I thought that was kind of cool. And I would like to have that cover, except it's probably priced too high, and I never buy, you know, I refuse to pay $50 for a comic book. But in any event, it's a pass for me. Oh, you're on mute, my friend. Sorry.
There we go. That's an open order cover. It's cover C. It's not a ratio cover, so you should be able to track it down.
Oh, maybe I will.
Yeah, okay, on to the last book that we're going to talk about in detail. It's Batman Dark Age number 2 from writer Mark Russell. Mike Allred is the artist, Laura Allred on colors, Dave Sharp on letters. I'll start with the art. I am such a fan of the storytelling aesthetic of Mike Allred, and his wife, Laura, is the perfect choice. She understands his sense of style so well that her colors always shine. Now, that being said, I've never been a fan of Allred's art because I don't care for the line weight. His line weights are so thick to me that it makes his images feel less fluid. And what I would love, and, you know, again, this is just my personal, completely subjective opinion because the guy is a legend and has a huge fan base. I would love to see him use a different line weight. Like, dude, you, like, Mike, draw this particular page and use the lightest line weight possible. And I just would like to see what it would look like. And it might turn out that for his storytelling sensibilities, a lighter line weight wouldn't work. Like, I could look at it and go, oh, that's awful. Just go back to, you know, doing what you're doing. Not that he needs to listen to me at all whatsoever. The guy's, you know, a huge name and has made a career for himself. I'm just talking about what about his art that I don't want to say that I find it off-putting, but why I'm not a huge fan of his art. Like, it's just the line weights. They're just so thick. So all that being said, I still absolutely love this issue. I love this idea of these Dark Age stories where it's basically a parallel DC universe. You know, this is a Black Label book where it's, you know, 20 years before the events of Crisis on Infinite Earths, where this reality is going to be erased from existence. Pariah, the character from Crisis on Infinite Earths, who is doomed to watch these realities be erased, is already there so that he can, you know, be subjected to the torture of seeing this reality be erased. He's already there. He's actually the head of Wayne Enterprises and help, you know, predicting the future, a future he already knows in terms of stocks and helping Wayne Enterprises make all kinds of great business decisions and what have you. And the fat cats are getting richer. And meanwhile, they framed Bruce Wayne. And in this reality, Bruce was not with his parents. He stayed at home the night they were gunned down in the alley. And that really led to sort of a despondent and reckless young Bruce Wayne, who would wander the streets at night and get in fights and what have you. And as his 18th birthday approaches, the fat cats on the board of Wayne Enterprises, they don't want Bruce Wayne to come in there and upset the apple cart. So they frame him for assault and, you know, all this other stuff, and they get him thrown in prison. Well, this is, as oftentimes Mark Russell does in these flashback type stories, he did it in Life Story Fantastic Four, or Fantastic Four Life Story, or what have you. And he did it with Superman Dark Age. He mixes in real life events. So around this time, the Vietnam War is going on. So Bruce Wayne is in prison in Blackgate Penitentiary, and it's not enough for him to be there because he'll get out eventually. So the people on the board of Wayne Enterprises are even going one step farther. They want to have him killed while he's in prison, because that's not really going to raise any eyebrows, right? If you just have him assassinated when he's out, then it's going to be a big police investigation and what happened or whatever. But if he's killed inside the walls of the prison, you just chalk it up to prison violence, right? And there's not a big investigation or whatever. They can sweep it under the rug. So Bruce is, you know, struggling to survive. Cause again, this is not a Bruce Wayne that's, you know, been trained to be Batman or what have you. But somebody is looking out for him, because Sam Lane, Lois Lane's father, shows up and says, and offers to commute his sentence in return for him going to war, going to Vietnam. And he's supposedly going to Vietnam to be a swim instructor in Saigon. But really what he's doing is he's joining this covert black ops team that's led by somebody, maybe you've heard the name Ra's al Ghul. And so there's some other people whose names, you know, you see here. I think there's a reference to an Oliver Queen and some others that are kind of those street level type characters that are part of this unit as well. And so that's what he does. He trains under Ra's al Ghul for a couple of years, becomes very formidable, what have you. And then he disappoints Ra's on a mission one night, and Ra's basically leaves him behind, and the rest of the covert ops team moves on. So he returns to Gotham and reconnects with Lucius Fox. He sees the terrible things that are happening, how there are so many people being marginalized and exploited and what have you. We get the first image here, the first instance of him donning the bat costume. You can see it there if you watch this on YouTube. Doesn't even have the bat on it yet, but this is him working with Lucius Fox to, you know, fight for people that need somebody to stand up for them. So again, it's a completely different take on Batman in a lot of ways. Maybe you could argue a more realistic take on Batman, but there's enough touchstones into the Batman that we know, into the mythos we know, to make it feel familiar and make it feel like it works. So I love this. You know, as much as I'm not a fan of Mike Allred's style, and I wasn't a fan of it on, you know, Superman Dark Age either, or Superman Space Age, that was nominated for an Eisner, and I had Mark Russell on the show to even talk about Superman Space Age, because I just loved it. I thought it was so well done. This is just as good, if not, dare I say, better, even though I'm much more of a fan of Superman than I am Batman. I think maybe due to the success of Space Age, maybe that's why Mark has a little more freedom, or maybe it's just Batman as a character leads itself to a little more subversion. Because the thing is, like, Superman's origin kind of stayed the same, and it was more about kind of what was leading up to the crisis on Infinite Earths, like, you know, the few years leading up to it, and then what would happen after, you know, we saw Superman and, you know, I won't spoil it, but it was fantastic. And it really leaned into the idea of Superman as a symbol of hope and kind of an unrelenting faith and belief in humanity and good, which, you know, that's at the heart of who that character is. That's not what is at the heart of Batman. At the heart of Batman is that relentlessness, that tenacious desire to fight for those that can't fight for themselves. So he's a different type of character that would involve, a different type of story to sort of fit into this aesthetic of the world, this market Russellverse, if you will. So there's nothing about this that I don't like. As much as I'm not a huge fan of the aesthetic of Mike Allred's art with those heavier line weights, I can't say it doesn't suit the story. I'm a big fan of this. As much as I liked the first issue, I thought the second issue was even better. So what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I like the fact that everything that happened was unexpected. I thought everything was out of left field here for me, and in a good way. I like the idea of Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne never, like you say, he never suffered the trauma that we associate with Batman. He never saw his parents murdered. So he grew up a spoiled brat. And it's the reality of war in Vietnam that he's forced to go to, that choices are made for Bruce. This is a Batman whose forces are foisted upon him. Batman in the traditional universe, the traditional Batman we know, chose to be Batman. He chose to be who he was. He chose to avenge his parents. He chose to, when he was young, to fight crime. He chose that he was going to train himself and avenge his parents. This is a Bruce Wayne who, in many ways, his life is was sort of pushing and pulling him in different directions. He ends up in Vietnam, against his will. He had no choice. It was either die and get killed in prison or go to Vietnam and probably get killed. And Ra's al Ghul's training him in Vietnam, and him and a bunch of other spoiled rich kids from families all over the globe. We only saw Oliver Queen. Who knows what other rich kids were there as well. Basically just sent there because of people wanting to get rid of kids so they don't inherit. And people like the Wayne Foundation consists of, individuals that don't want Bruce Wayne to return. And this is a story of a Bruce Wayne whose life really is, he's not in control of it. Even when he returns to Gotham, he returns to Gotham because he's discharged. Ra's kicks him out because he refuses to be to use lethal force. And he doesn't have that killer instinct. And so Batman returns, but he doesn't, it wasn't until Lucius Fox shows him this outfit, which would become his bat outfit, that Bruce finally starts to realize what his purpose might be. And he's still trying to figure that out. And I even like at the end where it looks like a character, it looks like Slade Wilson and a group of assassins goes into Wayne Manor to try to kill him. Of course, they get more than they expect with even Alfred with a shotgun and a very well-trained Bruce Wayne. And the other wild card here that I really like Pariah. Pariah is kind of a wild card here. Pariah, more so in this issue than the first issue. In the first issue, he seemed very rational that he wanted to take over Wayne Enterprises, push away Bruce Wayne. And here he seems a little bit more crazy. He's talking about the end of the world. He's talking like the pariah that we kind of all know and love. The one that's always seeing the end of times, always seeing the Armageddon. He's even a little bit reminiscent of the pariah we saw in Dark Crisis, sort of rambling about the end of things. We know the role that Pariah played in Superman Space Age. This is Batman Dark Age, and I think it's a different Earth than the continuity of Superman Space Age, although I might be wrong on that. I know you speculated otherwise yourself when we reviewed the first issue, but I'm really curious in terms of why is Pariah on this Earth? Why is he so fascinated with Wayne Enterprises? What else is different about this world? We see Lois Lane. We saw Lois Lane ask President Nixon a question here in this issue, and we know that Superman was referenced. Bruce Wayne in the narration, an older Bruce Wayne who's doing the narration, notes that he was in Vietnam when he first heard about rumblings of this Superman. But we've yet to see Superman in this second issue of Batman Dark Age 2. And I'm really curious to see where this is going. And, it's interesting. I know some people were complaining about this issue or complaining about the first issue about it maybe being a little bit off the beaten path or not the Batman they know. And disliking it for that reason, which is the very reason why I like it, because it is different. It's a different iteration of Batman. It sounds like you like it for that reason as well. In fact, one of the things as a quick aside, one of my comments about Ultimate DC, that were the rumor, the absolute DC universe rumors, which have been, I guess, now more or less substantiated or confirmed for the most part. What will the ultimate Batman look like come September? Well, I've seen so many iterations of Batman. I'm more interested in a different iteration of Superman and Wonder Woman than I am of Batman. I'll be blunt. If this was the ultimate Batman, I would have thought that would have been kind of cool because it's so different. I don't expect that because it's set in Vietnam in a different decade and what have you. But I'm actually kind of hoping that DC is not afraid to think. The creators are not afraid to really think outside the box for the Ultimate DC Universe. Not necessarily to this degree, but I like this. This was something that's a pleasant surprise. And it's one of those things where, isn't it interesting that I find myself migrating to these issues, these out-of-continuity tales. I often find myself reading them first before the other comics that I read. So as much as I love continuity in the DC universe, isn't it also kind of interesting that I find myself reading the first comic I read for the week is the one that I know is out of continuity. So it's interesting. But I thought this was very well done. I love Michael Allred. I don't have a problem with his line weights. I'm used to them. I fell in love with them on X-Force way back in the day. And his wife, Lawrence, does a good job too. And yeah, it was a pretty good creative team. And I'm looking forward to... Is this four issues?
I think it's three.
Three? Okay. I almost wish it was four because I don't know if we can wrap it up in one more issue. But whatever it is, I'll be happy. I hope.
Yeah, you make an excellent point about the fact that I wouldn't go so far as to say it's removing agency from Bruce Wayne. But I like what you're saying about, you know, this is a Bruce Wayne where the idea of being Batman it's kind of like external forces that are pushing him. In that way, as opposed to the Batman that we know, it's internal. I just think that's really an interesting juxtaposition. So when looking at it, it is four issues. And wow, the cover on issue four looks fantastic. So yeah, we'll see as far as the kind of the ultimate line or absolute line or whatever. So, you know, here's the thing, like there's a buzz about it. Here's it's going to happen and blah, blah, blah. It's coming in September. It's not like DC hasn't tried this before, but they couldn't stay on a... That's what the Earth One line was supposed to be, right? Coming out as these hardcovers. We had Superman Earth One. We had Batman Earth One. I would say either of those is worthy of being the ultimate, but I don't think you can go back to that well because too much time has gone by. I think we got three volumes of Superman Earth One. I think we had two of the Batman Earth One, which was Jeff Johns and Gary Frank. But yeah, I mean, I think the problem there is they were big, you know, they were standalone graphic novels basically. And so they took much longer to produce. If you want them on a monthly schedule, you got to do it a little bit differently. So, but I would be up for this version of Batman to be the absolute version. But yeah, as you mentioned, the timing just probably doesn't work out. But what I hope is that whatever absolute version of Batman we do get, it's at least as good as this Superman Dark Age. Or at least as good as Batman Earth 1, which I really enjoyed as well. Yeah. But anyway, that does it for the single issues that are out this week, everybody. There are a number of collections, starting with Zatanna by Paul Dini. It's 440 pages, $50. It collects the Zatanna 1 through 16 series, as well as a couple of specials for Zatanna. So if you're a big Zatanna fan, it's probably a must-read. We also have Flash Volume 20 trade paperback. This is collecting the end of the Jeremy Adams run. Highly recommend it. It's issues 797 through Flash 800. It's 128 pages. Then we've got Booster Gold, the complete 2007 series book one trade paperback. So this collects 0 through 14 of that Booster Gold run. Then we've got The Joker, The Man Who Stopped Laughing, Volume 2. This collects the second half of the Matthew Rosenberg recent Joker series, issues 7 through 12, which we weren't big fans of. But those are the collections that are out this week. So if you are so inclined, you like to wait in for trades or what have you, there's a number of decent trades out this week. So, Rocky, I know you had several books that you were considering for your book of the week. Have you narrowed it down?
Yeah, I did, actually. I thought about it. And I do have to go with... I'm going to go with Detective Comics. Because it just, for me, it was a payoff. I felt the crescendo. That was the name of the issue, part one crescendo. I felt Batman coming back. I felt rewarded. It felt cinematic in parts. I love the art. I love how things are wrapping up. And I love how he integrated Talia as well as Selina, and Batman was like a James Bond. He slept with both. I mean, he almost betrayed Selina, but he didn't, because Talia saved his life too. The two women that he's in love with played key roles in saving his life, both Talia and Selina. And Talia and Selina both love the same person, and there's always tension between Selina and Talia, and yet they both work together to save Batman's life. And then I still wonder if Selina knows that, just senses that Batman slept with Selina, or if maybe Talia called or actually called and told Selina behind the scenes. Because why Selina is talking to the Joker at the end of this issue, I don't know. But I don't know. I read these Detective Comics usually every time it comes out. I'm reading the issue twice, sometimes three times, because it's exposition heavy. I understand a lot of the criticism of Rambi at times, but this feels like a payoff for me. So that it gets my vote. And what about yourself?
Well, you can probably guess what mine is. It really was kind of a downer week for me. I don't know, a lot of the books really didn't speak to me this week. So I got to go with Batman Dark Age. I think it stood head and shoulders above everything else this week. I just thought it was really fantastic. So, I would have liked to – it's kind of weird, as much as I enjoyed Batman Dark Age. I wanted to read Primer this week, and it's weird. It was in the original digital press for this week, and the release date says it's coming out this week. But I don't see it on – particular sites that say it's coming out this week. So yeah. I don't know if it's come out. It's not like it got moved to a different week in our press area. Like it's, they delayed it a week or what have you. So I don't know if it's actually coming out this week or not. But I didn't get a chance to read it before it disappeared from this week in the press area. So yeah, maybe that would have been my book of the week. But regardless, Batman Dark Age, I thought was really fantastic. Really, really enjoyed it. So, well, that's going to do it for this episode, everybody. We appreciate you joining as always. Apologize for the rants again. Nothing personal against the creators. These books just really get us fired up sometimes. So that's a good thing. As we often say, the worst is to have no reaction at all. So anyway, like I said, that's going to do it for this episode. Don't forget to head over to Rocky's YouTube channel, especially if you're listening to us on the Comic Source audio feed. Head over to YouTube, Comic Space Boom! ! Is the channel. Once you're there, you know what to do. Like this video, subscribe, ring the notification bell so you know when new videos are coming out. Leave some comments below. Let us know your thoughts on the books this week. Conversely, if you check us out on YouTube every week and you are curious about the other audio-only content that comes out on the Comic Source, well, first of all, everything now for the Comic Source does come out on YouTube as well as audio only. But that's not to say there's not, over 2,000 episodes of audio content that you can go back and enjoy whenever you feel like it, long car ride, subway ride, whatever. Just go to your favorite podcasting platform, your favorite podcasting app, do a search for the Comic Source and subscribe. And don't forget, currently on the Comic Source YouTube channel, every day I'm releasing Spawn Daily, which is this project where I'm going through and reading not only all of the Spawn series, but also all the tie-ins, crossovers, miniseries, all that sort of stuff in a chronological order to get a great understanding of who Spawn is. It's an exciting time. I'm really enjoying where Spawn's going right now. We're getting close to issue 100. Big events happen in 100 that just recently were referenced in Spawn 350 that came out earlier this year. So if you read Spawn 350, never have read 100, yeah, have you, perfect time to go.
Now, I heard that there's a new ruler of hell in Spawn in 350.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And issue 100 has to do with the ruler of hell as well. So anyway, go and check it out if you are so inclined. We appreciate the support as always, everybody. That's going to do it for this episode. So thanks for watching, and we'll talk to you next time.
Catch you later.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.